Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to a Country First Conversation. We are excited to continue this new series to allow you the chance to participate and be a part of the conversation in choosing country over party. Now, following the insurrection at the Capitol back on January 6th, Congressman Adam Kinzinger launched the movement Country First as a home for principled Americans who are tired of the poisonous extremism that has overtaken our beloved nation politics. So if you haven't joined the movement, we invite you to do so. Go to the website, countryfirst.com. That's with a 1ST in the URL, countryfirst.com. Our most recent video on there shows Adam talking about fear and its impact in our politics today. Very powerful stuff. Get a chance to take a look, do so. And we have another one coming very, very soon. So look for that. Or all you have to do is just like and subscribe so that you know when all of our videos and content are posted on our social media pages. My name is Matt Rodewald. Glad to be with you today. I'll be hosting today's chat, keeping it moving for you. And joining me this afternoon, as always, Representative Adam Kinzinger from Illinois, a six-term congressman whose district goes from Winnebago County down to Watseka. And if you like pork chop sandwiches, oh, there's plenty of choices in the region. I would recommend Sycamore High School's concession stand during the strange spring football season. It's strange, but it smells good over there when you get a chance on a Friday night. Also with us this afternoon is SE Cup. You see her a lot on CNN. You can watch her show every Saturday, SE Cup Unfiltered, Saturdays, 6 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Central on CNN. How is everyone doing today?
Great. It's good to be with you, Cup. I'm glad you're here, Cup.
It's good to be with you.
So where do we start with the media? How about that? There's plenty to go, and let's try the emerging sides that we've seen the last few years of news versus opinion. And SE, I want to start with you, and I want you to try and explain the basics of this from a cable news perspective, because there are just so many viewers out there that simply don't understand which is which in today's media landscape. And that's fair to say. What is the best way for you to describe this whole setup, and what should people look out for when they're consuming content, particularly of political nature?
Yeah, I get this question a lot, and not just recently, but over the, 15, 20 years I've been doing this. How do we know what is what? What's the difference between opinion and news and analyst and reporter and anchor and host? And I get that it's confusing, and I'll speak to my brand first, and then more generally, I'm an opinion host. I was hired to give my opinion. Now, that doesn't mean I'm not also a journalist. I am. I came up through journalism, and I use journalism to inform my opinions. That's real important to me. Not always the case for every opinion host, and no judgment, but for me, it's important that I use, journalistic techniques, reportage, sourcing, calling people, doing some research so that when I get out and give my opinion, it's not quote unquote out of my ass. It's, from somewhere informed. That's a technical term.
And, you're right. Yeah.
And then of course there are reporters, and you want to have reporters who are not giving opinions, but really just sticking to facts. You have analysts who give some opinions based on analysis they've done in the field based on their experience and their expertise. But there is this sort of nebulous space now between host, infotainment, entertainment, news. And look, I think there's no problem with that per se, except when you're expecting people themselves to figure out what I can trust, what's real, what's fact, what's fiction. There was a recent lawsuit involving Tucker Carlson's show at Fox. And in that lawsuit, Fox explicitly admitted, Tucker should not be considered a source of news or fact. And that's, I think, would come as a big surprise to a lot of Fox viewers. Certainly, folks like my dad, who watch Fox and think whatever is being said is 100% true. And so what's true becomes true enough, becomes complete conspiracy theory. And then you have a real breakdown of trust in the news. And you've seen that deterioration in trust in the news over decades.
And I think that's like one of the important things to just even talk about that is, it's like with conspiracy, or when I talk about the use of fear to fundraise, it's just revealing what's happening. So people, you know, people can choose not to make an informed decision or an informed choice. They can choose, you know, as we all could, like, I'm going to watch opinion and pretend it's, you know, all fact. But I think the vast majority of people still, you know, don't want to be misled, don't want to misbelieve something. And so I think talking about the fact simply that there are opinion folks on the news, there's news people on the news, there's, you know, this kind of stuff is really important, you know, as a starting point. And I think it's a conversation that's happening now that, you know, Essie, you said you've addressed for a while, which is great. I'm just starting to hear it addressed, like, kind of in the political circles. And I think it's a good thing to do, to have that conversation with people and say, look, it's your choice what you want to believe, but here's the facts. So, like, Matt here actually was a local reporter for a while. That's how I met him. And, you know, when he was reporting, he'd ask hard questions, but it wasn't like based on I hate you or I like you. It was just here's the story, you know. But that is obviously very different than what you see on, you know, like CNN or Fox or something.
I think it's fair to say there's a certain divide with local news and national news, and we'll get into that a little bit. But I've covered politics in two different states, one leaning one way, one leaning the other way in terms of party interest. And you certainly get your complaints from viewers, whether you're trying to not favor one side or the other. And, you know, it's interesting, though, that, and that leads me to my next point with Adam. You go on CNN a lot, and every time you go on CNN, there's somebody out there that's saying, oh, he's just a Democrat, just, you know, posing as a Republican. When did you start hearing that? When did that start kind of coming into your head? Like, wow, I hear that a lot, or I noticed that.
Yeah. So it started probably, I'd say prior to Donald Trump, but not a ton prior. So it used to be, hey, we need more people to go on CNN. Because we want to share the, you know, go out and proselytize the Republican viewpoint. And it's important to have people there that are reasonable and can, you know, or, you know, MSNBC or whatever, and say the Republican viewpoint, even if you're not, if you're maybe a little moderate on some issues, just to like show people. And then it became sometime, particularly when Donald Trump came on the scene, when it became now your news source wasn't just maybe you're complaining about a bias. It's like you are that person now if you're on there. And, you know, Essie, I'm sure, gets this all the time. She's a Republican, but it's like, I'm not real. You're right. I'm right. And so I go on there and, you know, and obviously I'm independent of what I believe, but we, you know, I'm a Republican, I'm a conservative. And yeah, so I'd say that started about probably about 5 years ago, but I'm not going to let it, you know, affect me, because on the contrary, if you go on like a conservative show and are an independent, they're going to block you out anyway, because they want you to come on, you know, and just tell them what they already know and feel good about. It's amazing.
You're listening to a Country First conversation, and we'll get back to this conversation in a second. Essie Cupp is our guest today, CNN host and author. Essie, jump in on that. I know you heard some of that. You froze up for a second, so go ahead and feel free to weigh in.
Well, a couple things. I worked at Fox. I had a show at MSNBC. Show at CNN now. So I've gotten all the kinds of receptions that Adam has talked about based on, you know, where I've been. And so I've really learned to ignore it, because it doesn't affect what I say or what point of view I'm coming from. It says more about the people watching than it does about me. And I learned this mostly after Trump. You know, my resistance to Trump was early and often. And for a lot of people, like Adam talks about, that made me a cuck. It made me a liberal. I would get texts and email after email and text after text, like, what happened to you? You used to be such a good Republican. And I'd have to be like, Dad,
Mom,
Grandma. You know, like, wow.
But I, you know, I'd have to be like, listen, I have not changed a single opinion
right.
I had, you know, before Trump to after Trump. I'm still against tariffs. You have decided all of a sudden to be completely into them. I have always been against the debt and the deficit, and you seem to have forgotten about that stuff. So I try to remind folks who are critical of my points of view now that they haven't changed. So I there's not a lot of credit given right now for intellectual consistency.
That's right.
But it matters to me, right?
It should.
And I try to be where I always have. And that doesn't mean you don't grow and reinform your opinions and moderate opinions. Of course you do. But I never try to think about what I'm saying through the lens of or the filter of where I'm saying it or, you know, what audience is listening at the time.
Yeah, that's what I think is pretty cool is like, you know, you built a great following on CNN. And, I don't know, but I'm sure when you got the show, when you started, it was probably a question that was up in the air. You know, are CNN viewers ready for SE Cup? And you did a good job of building that brand and being fair. And you know, as a Republican, and it's like you look at it and it's like, well, you push Republican views on that, but you do it in a reasonable way. And you're looking at all sides, which some people have just forgotten is the way things used to be. I think actually one of the first times I met you, if not the first time, I was on Crossfire back when I don't know how long ago that was, maybe 6-7 years ago. And that's a heck of an interview, by the way. That's one of the tougher interviews because it is just rapid fire. Bam, bam, bam. But when it's done, everybody's pals. Was it Van Jones, I think, on with you?
Yeah. So Crossfire was so much fun. It was Van Jones, me, Stephanie Cutter, and Newt Gingrich, which is an odd group of folks. And yeah, as you say, it is one of the tougher interviews. You've got it's always, no matter where you are on the spectrum, three against one. Because even though you come on as a Republican and I'm there ostensibly as the Republican, I'm still going to grill you. And so you've got, you know, essentially two Democrats and me, your Republican friend, in quotes, who's still going to sort of give you some tough questions. So it really was, I think, as intended, a really good showcase of good journalism and trying to get at issues from a serious and substantive way. But I tried to take that onto every platform I've had where if I'm talking to Van, I want to start from where we agree. Let's figure that point out and then we can move outwards from there. If I'm just looking to yell at someone, I can go on anyone else's show to do that. It's just not interesting to me. I don't think it's productive. And so for me on my various platforms, I really do try to have good conversations. And you know, Adam, I've had you on, I've argued with you. I've asked you tough questions. I've also had you on to highlight important issues and, you know, to talk about things that I know you and I care about. So that's what I try to do. I can't speak for everyone else, you know, on cable news, but I always want to have a good conversation. If I'm having you on my show, it's because I want people to hear your opinion, not because I want to shout you down or embarrass you. Even if I disagree with you, I want people to hear it.
Yeah.
Essie, I think a good journalist that is in a position like you with a source you like, but someone you're willing to challenge, wants to be able to draw the best out of that source in an interview. And sometimes it sounds challenging, but what it ends up being is it brings out the best in both in the conversation. Do you get that feeling sometimes when you maybe talk to someone of like-minded political beliefs that, you know what, I want to make sure everything is coming out in the forefront that should be there that represents what I think a view should be? The element of news versus opinion, sometimes you're just kind of firing the ratings and we'll get to the fear factor and all that. But is there an element of truth to that where you're just trying to draw out the best you can?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's my job. I'm hosting not just to give you my take or else I wouldn't have any guests on. But I'm hosting to host a conversation, right? I'm supposed to be a facilitator, a mediator. I want you to get the best information, which is sometimes going to be stuff I don't agree with. Stuff I don't like, but I'm trying to filter it for you so that when you tune in to my show, at least, you know, you're getting my opinion, but also some facts. You're also getting some background and context, and you're hearing from people across a spectrum. And I think, you know, if I can check those boxes, every, you know, for every segment or every show, then I've done as good a job as I can.
So I recently watched, Essie did an opening on guns and I thought it was really well done where, you know, Essie and I are both, you know, pro Second Amendment, you know, and you know, as some are aware, in the last year I switched and supported universal background checks. And I want to have conversations about, you know, yeah, do we, should you be able to buy an AR-15 at 18? You know, when you have to be 21 to buy a pistol? These are kinds of things that I think, you know, we should actually be having in a conversation. And frankly, for me as a Second Amendment supporter, I think it's on people like us to try to find ways to, you know, both preserve our freedom to do that, but also understand that, you know, there's real concerns out there. But she gave a very introspective kind of intro or monologue, which is like, hey, here's what I would normally say in response. But the truth is, we've got to get past our knee-jerk reaction to, I guess, ignore each other, to not have this talk, and actually really do that. And I thought, actually, I was really impressed by that, because it was like, you weren't saying we need to ban all guns. You weren't saying we need to do nothing. It was just like, we actually need to take the barriers down, quit looking at the politics, and see if there's an area.
Well, I can't get outside of my my job. I have to ask you a question, because you and I think, have approached this issue similarly. And we didn't talk about it. We didn't do it together. We just, I think, came to the same kind of point that we were sick and tired of the same cycle of inaction and conversations that talk past each other. And I know from my point of view as a gun rights defender, right? I really stuck to the slippery slope. Make no concessions. Really, you really can't allow for any movement on this issue, or suddenly all your rights are going to sort of flood away. And when I was able to put that down and say, look, there's got to be something, there's got to be some stuff that we can do that will A, actually help solve a problem, maybe not the whole problem, but a part of the problem, and B, won't infringe on, you know, half the country's right to bear arms, we got to start talking about that. I want to know, for you, were you concerned about the blowback you would get for suddenly supporting background checks or anything as small as it seems to a lot of people inside our community? It's a huge, huge deal.
It is, yeah. And I'll tell you how the whole thing came down is, you know, I woke up the morning after Vegas, you know, saw the video, heard the audio, and I had shot bump stocks a few times, and I'm like, look, you know, as a shooter, I like shooting bump stocks. They're fun. It's wasteful. They're not accurate, but you know, they're fun. But I looked at it and I said, well, we ban automatic weapons, so a bump stock is basically just a cutesy little way around something that Congress has determined should be banned, you know, unless you have an FFL and certain licenses. And so I came out and called for banning bump stocks. And then, you know, the discussion about, okay, if you have to be 21 to buy a pistol, you know, an AR-15, maybe you should have to be 21. And I went from an A some rating with the NRA down to a D- because of that. And I realized at that point, keep in mind, the NRA pulled out a full page ad in 1999 for universal background checks.
Yeah.
They were supportive. But what happens is now they're competing with the gun owners of America, who are the ones that say, you know, felons should be able to buy guns.
Yeah.
There's like no limit whatsoever. And you just realize, okay, The NRA is not being honest here. They're going to use fear to fundraise. The slippery slope argument, it's a concern, but it's also a concern based in fear. And the reality is, if you start down that slippery slope, then just resist it at the slippery slope. But it doesn't mean that we have to, you know, fetishize guns in this country. It doesn't mean that we have to, you know, do nothing. And that to me was kind of a real eye-opening moment. And so that's kind of emboldened me. And things like the background checks, you know, I have a gun manufacturer in the district, and these manufacturers are like, yeah, we believe in universal background checks. Like, and you know, and so that to me was that eye-opening thing of like, you just do what's right, and ultimately it's going to work out in the end. And the other thing, though, to be fair to my friends on the other side of the aisle, when we talk about things like mental health, you know, some people may be using that to get away from talking about guns.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also a real issue. And I think we have to recognize, if somebody's going to pull the trigger, it is a mental health issue. We can do all of it.
100%. And I think that point is important too. I want to come to the table genuinely, earnestly, and with an open mind. And I want the same. And so, you know, there are non-starters. You know, when I start putting up defenses like, well, whatever law you're suggesting Democrats wouldn't have solved the last shooting, wouldn't have prevented the last shooting. Well, that's a conversation ender, right? You don't move anywhere past that. I don't want conversation enders from the other side either, where I come to the table and you say, well, are you a Republican? Yeah. Are you a gun owner? Yeah. Well, then you've got blood on your hands. Well, you know, I'm as a law-abiding gun owner, I'm not responsible for this, and that's not productive either. And I just find whether it's guns or immigration, so many issues, you don't have a lot of people willing to come to the table anymore, have those real conversations, concede a point, find some compromise, and actually try to solve a problem. It's politically profitable to leave a lot of problems broken. And that's, I think, why so many voters are frustrated with government.
And I think, too, just real quick, you know, sometimes you've got to step back and look at the forest. And when you look at gun rights in this country, the big strides that they've made over the last 20 years. I mean, Illinois, for goodness sakes, has concealed carry. Wisconsin, every state now has concealed carry. Every state, you know, the courts have defended your right to keep and bear arms. You know, there used to be, you know, capacity limits on, you know, if you can only carry 7 rounds and a pistol, and those are gone. Like, there's all kinds of stuff. So, you know, celebrate the gains you've made. But then when you do stuff like walk into, you know, a state capitol with an AR-15 just because you can, you're actually part of the problem. And you're the reason that there's going to be a slippery slope, if anything. Not voting for background checks. It's you walking around with an AR flaunting your rights and threatening people.
It's a Country First Conversation with S.E. Cupp and Adam Kinzinger. You can watch her on CNN. You can also read her in the New York Daily News as well. And you mentioned the knee-jerk reaction element of this conversation when it comes to gun ownership. And I want to switch that over to fear because, Adam, we've talked about fear in the past. And we've talked about what drives it in the media element. And rhetoric is one thing, but sometimes they need that outlet in order to be able to push that fear as well. And it's easy, very easy to just look at Fox News and say, hey, it's their fault. But every outlet has had their hand in it one way or another. What has to change? You know, does it have to be the media to kind of have restraints on these things and not say, ooh, that's a good guest for ratings? They'll go off for a little bit. They'll bring in the horde of people to watch for those 20 minutes and you get the quarter hour and boom, there's your ratings point for advertisers. Is that part of it? Or what do you think in terms of just the conversation and what media has to do to kind of maybe restrain this conversation a bit?
Well, look, I'll answer that first and just say, I think it starts with an understanding that, you know, when, you know, back, what, 50 years ago, news was considered a public service by TV stations. And then we got a very different media environment. There's a bajillion channels. You know, now there's multiple news channels. And you know, what started happening is obviously you got to make money to stay in. All of a sudden, there's a profit motive. And I personally think from our end, you know, as politicians, as leaders, it starts with just making people aware of the role of fear. Because I think when it comes to some things in the media, look, if fear is going to drive ratings, you know, short of government regulations, it's going to be tough to change any kind of a mode or motive. But if people quit watching, you know, fear-based TV and they listen to good opinion-based TV that brings in both sides or whatever, consumers vote consciously with what they watch. And I think it's important for anybody to recognize that and to recognize that what you're watching and what you're putting in your body, I mean, it's just like food. We like to eat kale all the time. You know, I love kale, actually, but we try to eat all healthy and stuff. And I used to hate it, but I like it. But you realize that you know, whether it's you're watching a movie, whether it's news, whether you're one of these people that for 15 hours a day you do nothing but pull in the news that agrees with you and get really, you know, pissed off in the basement, that is the same as eating food. And if you're eating Twinkies and you're eating fear, you're gonna look like a Twinkie and you're gonna be a fearful person.
And I'll just add, I mean, we are, whether you bemoan this or not, it's a fact, we're a business. And to Adam's point, we respond to supply and demand. I mean, if y'all wanted C-SPAN, we'd look like C-SPAN.
You'd be watching it. Yeah.
We would look like C-SPAN, but you don't. And so I've said this for years. Some of this is on the consumer. It's on you. We're giving you what you tell us with a lot of research and metrics that you want. And so I'm defensive of my industry, not because I'm inside it, but because, you know, we are a reflection of what people want. And again, you can think that's for the better or worse, and certainly make the argument that it's collectively for the worse, but that's just the reality. And so it's up to consumers to turn the channel or demand something better. And I think, and Matt, you mentioned earlier, you wanted to talk about local news. I think a tangent off of this is that we have put too much of a premium on national news.
Yes.
That's become a soap opera. That's become, I mean, the election never ends. The presidential election never ends. It is 4 years long. It is continuous. And we obsess over it. And politics has become a never-ending Super Bowl. And the important thing that we're missing is the local news, the local stories, the local politics happening in our backyard. And I would argue your day-to-day life is much more affected by what's happening at your local school board, sanitation board, you know, your local government than anything that is happening in Washington, D.C. And, you know, at CNN and outfit like CNN, we have reporters everywhere. And so we're covering local news, but we are not covering it all the way your local newspaper can, the way your local television station can. And the importance of local news, I can't overstate. Local stories have a way, if they're done right, of becoming national stories. I can point to, you know, the Boston Priest story.
Absolutely.
Husky at Penn State. Epstein story was uncovered in Miami and you know, blew up from there. Syria, which started as a local protest, became national and international news thanks to local news coverage. So if we cared more about local news than we do about national news, I think you'd see people like Mike Bloomberg investing billions of dollars into local news instead of a national presidential run or his own, you know, mega news channel. And the death of local news is because we have stopped demanding more local news coverage. And it's really, really dangerous. And we're all going to suffer for it.
Yeah. And I tell you, that's why I'm very defensive of local news, too, because, you know, look, selfishly as a congressman, if I go into Rockford, you know, it's nice to be covered, right? Because then people see that you were there. They see what you're doing. But, you know, unselfishly, the idea is during the pandemic, you know, you can watch and see the death numbers and see the bad or whatever. But local news would talk about how does it affect you here? What is the local school group doing, you know, to volunteer? And it connects you to community. And by the way, you know, on the reflection of the media reflecting people, it's the same with politicians. People look to politicians to save everything. And, you know, I'm going to do my best to provide that example. But who you vote for is what your politicians are going to look like. And if being, you know, crazy gets you more votes, you're going to be crazy. And I think that's where we have to get away from this shedding responsibility and realize that every one of us have a responsibility for both our behavior and our consumer activity and our votes.
You know, SC, when you have a guest on and you know their angle and then you know their motivation, but when they start lying, when they start pushing false narratives, and you know it too, and you're ready to call them, how do you stop that? And how do you kind of get to a point where it's like, you know what, maybe I can't have that guest on anymore? Not only from the responsibility of what you do as a journalist versus mixing in the balance of ratings, is it worth it? That kind of conversation. How's that work in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, that's something we're talking about a lot in the media right now. You know, do we have on guests that we know are liars? And that was particularly acute during the Trump administration when people from inside the administration would lie. Not exclusive to the Trump administration, by the way, but you know, certainly did it with alacrity. And so do you have someone on like the press secretary who you know is going to lie or do you not? I mean, it's a tough call. And I think there are different schools of thought on it. For me and the show I had, I didn't want to have liars on. I didn't want to amplify their voices. And that doesn't mean that sometimes I didn't have some unknowingly on. And then you have to deal with that in the moment. But to me, my show's only as good as the guests and the information we put out there. And so if you're going to have someone on who you know is going to say false things, I don't think you're being a very good steward. But on the other hand, there's a really good argument for this sort of the performative aspect of cable news, where you have someone on that you know you disagree with and you know they might not tell the truth, but you are prepared to systematically take apart their argument. That is a service that, you know, viewers can benefit from that, you know, might not read it in a 24-page long-form journalism piece in The Atlantic, but they might sit through it when Tucker Carlson does it, or when, you know, Brooke Baldwin does it on CNN, or when Rachel Maddow does it in the first 25 minutes of her show, which is, you know, how she opens every show. So the performative aspect of having someone on to take apart an argument and reveal the lies or reveal the inaccuracies, if done correctly, I think has some value. And some people are really good at it. I'm not one of those people, but some people are really, really excellent at it.
Adam, jump in here.
Yeah, I'll tell you what's interesting for me is like, so, you know, obviously, you know, a lot of Republicans say, oh, CNN XYZ and Democrats, oh, Fox News XYZ. And so there's going to be a flare, you know, and whatever in either station. But where I think there's got to be the deep, I don't know, I hate when people say real conversation, because that's just like punting, right? But I do think in this case, it's going to have to be a conscious thought about this, which is, when does speech cross into yelling fire in a theater? So I take that. Let's take the whole idea of a stolen election. If you only watch Fox or you only watch Newsmax, right, you 100% believe the election was stolen because you heard no counter argument. I mean, I would even try to get on Fox to give it, and they wouldn't let me on. And it's not because we're not trying to go on or I want to avoid Fox News. It's because my narrative counters what they're pushing. And then when you have from there, you know, 74 million people believing that they were disenfranchised, not outnumbered, just disenfranchised. And then you have something like you had on January 6th. This is where it crosses into the idea of there is a responsibility by, you know, organizations pushing that. They have crossed into, you know, beyond First Amendment privilege and rights. So it's one thing to have an opinion that says, you know, Donald Trump is responsible for the pandemic versus no, somehow Democrats are responsible for the pandemic. That's one thing. But now we have an insurrection. Democracy doesn't work because they steal your votes. And here's a video. Oh, by the way, they just disproved it, but we're not going to talk about it. That's a real danger. And that's a real problem.
Couple more minutes here on A Country First Conversation. Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, SC Cup of CNN. One more for both of you. And I want to start with you, Adam. You were at an event the other day in Will County, spoke to one reporter that was there. Four questions or so, very basic, nothing fancy. You're on the record and you go on with your day. You know, if we did that every day to lawmakers around the country, if journalists did that every day to lawmakers, wouldn't you think the level of accountability might actually increase across the board if there is just at least a reporter once, just asking the basic stuff of the day, maybe the news of the day, and maybe a curveball on an occasional issue that you may not been prepped for. Wouldn't you think that would kind of be better for the health of the country in terms of engagement and accountability?
Yeah, I do. I think when, you know, reporters, you can throw in a curveball, tough questions. I don't actually mind tough questions at all. Where I can get perturbed is a gotcha question, right? A gotcha question is intended for nothing except to catch you off guard, make you look stupid, or make you accidentally say the wrong thing that can live forever. And that's no service to anybody, right? That's just, oh, look, Adam looked dumb this one time, or he said something that he didn't mean, but we're going to just run with it as he did. But I do think, you know, like legitimate questions. What do you think of Biden's infrastructure? What do you think about guns? Like, that's important because that's how you get a message out to the people you represent of what you believe, what you're thinking. At the same time, you know, while I say in a case like that, you know, curveball, tough questions is fine. Gotcha questions is a totally different thing. Not every person in the media is out to destroy you, right? And it's like, you know, it's a point where we all have to understand that we all play a very important role in democracy. And democracy, by the way, we inherited such a strong democracy that it feels easy to us, but now we're starting to see that it's not. And it is actually a really tough responsibility. It's much easier to live under a dictator who tells you what to do. But as Essie and I are both very, you know, engaged in Syria, dictatorships don't work, and it leads to people literally, you know, it's funny when people tell me I'm like heroic for my stand, you know, sure, I guess in the context, maybe people can say that, but heroism is the hundreds of thousands of people in Syria that have given their lives for the future of their government. And, you know, that's real. Or for the people that go into the military or go fight and die in a war. And our sacrifices are pretty pale in comparison.
Essie, real quick, rapid fire. You hear from young reporters in small markets and the element of local news. What do they always ask you? What's the one thing they want to know?
Oh, how do I get my own show on television? And I say, oh, my God, wrong question. Wrong question. You know, A, your value is exactly where you are, both to you and everyone else. To you, get that experience. Stay there. Experience everything you can in a small market and get sharp, get good at this job, and also stay there. Your community needs you. You know, like politics, the media has become a lot about fame and celebrity and power and proximity to power and whose Christmas list we can get on. And it's, you know, it's gross to me. You know, maybe surprisingly to people, because here I am at a national network, you know, with a national platform, but that's not where we all have to be. And I don't think you should want to go into journalism to be a national figure, just like I don't think we should be looking for people to go into politics to become famous. Politics is public service, and journalism should be a public service too, even if you're talking about pop culture or you're doing movie reviews or, you know, you're at a national level or a local level. If we think about the service first, then I think we're both doing a better job for ourselves and our communities, and our industry will benefit from that and will benefit from more trust and more access. All of those things are important to journalists, and we're losing trust and access, two things we really, really need, both because of some of the things we've done and then some of the very successful attempts, you know, on the Trumpy side to undermine us. And, you know, both things are working against us right now.
You sparked something I want to say real quick, though, too. It's like, it's the same, almost the same advice I give to anybody that wants to run for office. Like, I feel lucky, you know, to be where I am, to have gotten elected at 31, very young for that. You were young in journalism when you started to be a national figure. And you know, before you're there, you know, that's something that's great to attain. But one thing people don't think through until they get there is, you know, once you've kind of reached the top, right, you're in the top, now you have to struggle with that real question. This is just a very real moment I'm sharing. You struggle with that question of, what's next, or there is no next. If you're already on top, it's like, you know, and that's where I think some people get desperate to go even a step above and then find themselves wrestling with the same questions, because eventually nobody will know the name Adam Kinzinger unless you Google it. And I'll probably be alive when that happens, you know, and what will matter to me is my family. But if you don't invest in anything outside of that, and your image becomes that, especially when you're young, you are setting yourself up for a real crisis of identity when it's over. And so there is real value in taking your time. And if you don't get to, quote unquote, the top, you'll get to your top. And you'll also have transitioned to seeing other things as important that are lasting. But then if you do get there, you will be a much better rounded person. Or inevitably, when you get out of that and you have to find who you really are.
What do you tell freshman lawmakers when they ask you how to handle the media?
Well, I just say, look, actually, this is what I say. I go, don't memorize what you're going to say. Just believe what you're going to say. Don't worry about stumbling. Yeah, stumbling can be embarrassing. But if you're speaking from the heart and you're speaking truth, that's even if you stumble speaking truth and from the heart, I think people react far better and understand what you're saying than if you're a programmed politician that never makes a mistake.
Well, and that's why, just from my point of view, you're a very good guest. It doesn't matter that I agree with what you're saying, even when I don't, because there's a difference between being prepared and being rehearsed. You're always prepared, but you never sound rehearsed. And I think that's what makes you an authentic politician, an authentic person, and why people want to hear what you have to say, because they know they're going to get a straight answer that's not just a memorized, you know, one sheet. That's really something you believe and something you've thought a bit about and you've, you know, spent time preparing, and you're giving them the straight, you know, the straight take.
Thanks.
That was like when an interviewer or an interviewee takes a second to answer a question, or just kind of takes a step back, kind of like you can see them thinking just a little bit. Then you know that there's an element of preparation versus rehearsal that they're trying to wrestle between. I thought that, I always think that's really good. Final thoughts for everybody. Essie, why don't you go first? Just some final thoughts on just where this is going to go from here. Where are we going in the next, say, 6, 12, 18 months?
God, I mean, this is, I've been asking this for 4 years. I think midway through the Trump administration, I wrote a long piece for Vanity Fair talking about the conservative coma and wondering if conservatism was going to wake up at some point. And now I'm sort of looking ahead, and I think it's real clear where the Republican Party wants to go, you know, generally speaking, and that is doubling down to win the midterms, and they'll probably double down again to try to win the presidency in 2024, and certainly not where I'd want things to go. But I'm left less concerned about the future of the Republican Party than I am conservatism. As a set of ideals, they're not going away. I know that, but who will amplify them? Who will come along to give them voice in a way that is saleable, in a way that is impactful? And, you know, maybe that's Adam. I wish him luck in doing that. Certainly, I am hopeful that someone can come along and speak truth to the conservative principles that, you know, we've believed in for a century. But, you know, what happens to the Republican Party is entirely up to the Republican Party. And, you know, we've seen the choices that the party has made over the past 4, 5, you could argue 8, 10 years. So I don't have answers. As a journalist, I ask this very question. What is going to happen next every single day? And, you know, stay tuned.
I agree. It's a matter now of, you know, yeah, the party, I think generally, even if they didn't officially do it, members of the party have made the decision they're going to double down on the Trump strategy to win the midterms. But Essie made the point, which is 100% true. If we win the majority, or even if we lose, we stay in the minority, the question will be, well, it's too late to change courses now because the presidential election's just around the corner. And that's how it always works. So you have to make a conscious decision to change it. You're going to take hits. People will declare that you're trying to tear the party apart. I say, no, I'm just presenting an alternative idea to the millions of people that deserve to hear it. And so, look, you know, you take good candidates like Michael Wood in Texas 6, who, you know, I found him just because he had said in a, you know, crowded primary that the party needs to move on from Trump. And, you know, whether he wins or lose, and we support him, and I hope he wins, but he is going to advance the cause by simply telling the truth. If Country First, you know, does what I hope it does, then, you know, we'll revolutionize conservatism in the party. But even if it doesn't, we will have advanced that ball, and somebody else can come and pick up that baton. And you have to be willing to do hard work and not get credit for it, because if you only want credit for it, you'll never succeed.
We are short on time. Essie, come back someday soon. We'd love to do more on this. There's a whole lot we can do.
Anytime.
We barely touched upon Syria. I'd like to get into that at some point. So hopefully we get a chance to do this again. So thank you, everyone. Essie Kupp, you can see her on CNN Saturdays. I believe it's 6 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Central. It's Essie Kupp Unfiltered. And as I've mentioned before, we're at the beginning of these conversations that Country First will be hosting. With the need to put country over party, go to our website, countryfirst.com, 1ST. That's in the URL. Make sure that you subscribe to receive all the latest updates. All of our podcasts, you can find them on our YouTube channel. And hey, make sure you get a chance to watch and share on your social media channels as well. My name is Matt Rodewald. Thank you again for joining us. And we will see you next time as we put country over party.